For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week, award-winning author Shirley Mann reveals how moved she was by the reaction of an RNIB library customer to one of her novels. Loyal listener Penny Melville Brown reviews some cat-and-mouse thrillers from the other side of the Atlantic. And Paralympic gold medalist Libby Clegg discusses her book, My Life with Hattie, A Dog Who Knows Everything. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Shirley Mann's novel, Bobby's War, won the 2021 RNA Romantic Saga of the Year Award. And, like her debut, Lily's War is a meticulously researched reimagining of the active role that women played on the home front during World War II. The former journalist was inspired by her own parents' wartime experiences, as I discovered when she joined me from her home in Derbyshire. Shirley Mann, welcome to Read On.
Oh, it's so lovely to be here.
Now, I believe that you're hard at work on the third and fourth novels, but let's go back to the first novel, Lily's War, which is set in Manchester in 1942 and was inspired by your own parents' romance.
Yes, it was. The story of my parents had been with me for a long time. I'd heard snippets over the years. My dad unfortunately died when he was only 66, but my mum went on till she was 90. And anybody who's got any elderly relatives will know that the last years can sometimes be quite difficult. And my mum had macular degeneration disease, so couldn't read the papers as much as she could or books. She also lost some hearing. So she started to talk more about the early days of when she was in the WAF. And for a very ordinary girl from Manchester, the years that she was in the WAFs was a shining time for her. It was so exciting. So she told me snippets of things. And in those last few years, I thought, I've got to write these down. So I did make notes, not really knowing whether I would ever write a novel, but I am a journalist and they say there's a novel in all of us. So I thought, well, I may as well give it a go. And I just sat down to write. And then I thought, oh no, this won't work. I don't know enough. So I raced around the country talking to as many service people as I could to get their personal stories. And I feel really privileged that I was able to take down their legacy, because a lot of these women's stories have been lost. They're things that aren't in the history books. And I love that. I love being able to be a conduit to let generations for the future know what these women were like, what their jobs were like, what their minutiae of everyday life was like. And I just loved that. But I needed a good base of people to talk to so that I could then write my first novel.
And Lily, like so many of those young women back in the 1940s, wants to do her bit for the war effort rather than just knitting socks for the servicemen, which was a very important thing in itself. She wants to get more actively engaged and, like your mum, volunteers for the Women's Auxiliary Air Force and becomes a wireless operator, which was a very responsible job.
It was incredibly responsible. And I think you talk about these girls sitting at home. You have to remember that in the 1930s and early 40s, they were just expected to take over from their mums in the kitchen. And all of a sudden, they saw an escape route. And I think they grabbed it with both hands, most of them. Some of them took a little bit of turfing out, but most of them did. And they suddenly found they were propelled into this really exciting world. Now, a lot of girls did very ordinary jobs, but they were replacing men. And that gave them a huge kudos. And I was lucky, if you like, in the fact that my mum did something that was very exciting to write about, which is that she was a wireless operator and she was seeing Lancaster crews in and out using Morse. And she was right on the front line of things. And therefore, there was an awful lot of excitement in there that I could home in on.
And yet, even in the years following the war, these, as you say, were stories that weren't really recorded. It was far more normal to see films like The Dam Busters, where really women have a very incidental part and it's the men flying the planes who everybody is concentrating on.
Yes, I didn't want to write about heroes, really. I wanted to write about the backroom people, and each of my books has sort of done that. Well, apart from the one about the air transport auxiliary pilot who flew planes, and her life was definitely glamorous and exciting. Mm-hmm. But I did want to write about what the normal girls did, because I don't want to glamorize this, but I did want to point out just how important they were in a very small way. And everybody doing their very small bit added up to such a huge story.
The counterpoint to the excitement of Lily and the other girls in the other stories who we'll come on and talk about is the rationing, the lack of clothing, the constant threat of aerial bombardment. It really was quite grim at times.
Yes, yes, I think it's very tempting when you start to write a novel to want to write something nice. And actually, I thought, no, I don't want to do that. If you like, I hoped I was a better writer than that. I wanted to write as it really was. They're not saccharine books. They're not sweet and twee in any shape or form. They're not gruesome, but they do tell it as it was. And I think that was really important to my credibility as a journalist. I wanted to just rise above any temptation to be too sweet and sugary. And it was not. The only thing I did want to get over was the sense of humour, because I think that's what got them through. They had to have a sense of humour. They had no choice. You know, I look at our youngsters now, and my daughter had trouble going on a tube. I mean, she was terrified at the age of 16. And these women just were thrust into this world where they were just expected to do so much, and they took it all in their stride because actually they had no choice. And the person next to you was doing it. And many of them said to me, if we ever complained, all you got back was, don't you know there's a war on? My daughters will tell you that they are fed up of me saying, you know, well, we're not in a war situation. And every time I've been fed up in COVID, I've rung my 95-year-old WAF plotter called Helen Mills, who has just kept me going because she's so matter of fact. And she said to me, well, there's no point in moaning, Shirley. You just have to KBO, which, excuse the language, is what Churchill said, but keep buggering on. And actually, you know, she had no choice. She's 95, 96 now, and she couldn't go out for months. She could only get into her garden, but she took huge pleasure in the small things in life. And I've learned so much from these women. I am just in awe of them and feel really humbled by them. They've taught me so much.
One of the things that struck me is there's no doubt in any of the young people's mind as to how right it is to be at war. The only doubts that creep in are in their relationships, because Lily is worried whether her relationship with her boyfriend, who is away fighting overseas, is going to last.
Exactly. I mean, this was the thing when I started to write this book, because, yes, my mum and dad had a wonderful romantic romance. But to be honest, they didn't meet each other for 6 years. And once I started to write it, I thought, you stupid woman, why have you done this? This is going to be impossible to write. But in fact, I think I found a way to do it that works with letters. And I gave both points of view. So you actually get a dual story going on of Danny's very exciting, very different war, which is in the 8th Army going up through Africa and then Sicily and Italy. And that was much more graphic, if you like, in what they had to put up with. But at the same time, they were just young people. And as far as a WAF was concerned, a boyfriend was an essential prerequisite. You had to have one. And they went from one to another. And I think probably because they didn't sleep with them all, some did, but very few did, it did mean that they could move on very quickly. And boy, they went through them.
Now, we've touched upon your second novel, Bobby's War, which has recently come into the RNIB library, like Lily's War. Bobby's War is inspired by the wonderful story of Mary Ellis and the other glamour girls who served in the ATA flying planes across the country.
Once I'd heard about these women, and I'd never heard of them, and that's something else I do want to do with my books. I want to take people somewhere they might never have been, to an area of the war they might never have really known very much about, you know, these backroom people, as I was talking about. And I heard about the ATA pilots and I heard about Mary Alice, and I managed to find out she would see me, and I was so thrilled. And I live in Derbyshire. It never occurred to me to ask where she lived. She lived in the Isle of Wight. So I thought, right, off you go. And fortunately, this was pre-COVID, but she was 100 at the time, and I had this date in June to go and see her. Well, she died in the July of 2018. So I was incredibly lucky to go and see her. But I arrived on her doorstep and it had been raining and I got lost, and I was with my little trolley dolly thing and I was trundling along across a golf course and then had to climb a fence. I was in a right state, honestly, for a professional author. I looked an absolute sight. And I arrived on her doorstep looking absolutely drowned. And she came to the door in a pair of blue slacks and a white shirt, looking the consummate professional. And she took absolutely no notice of the fact when I squelched through her house with my bare feet. You know, I was so wet. And we spent a wonderful few hours where I found out what it was really like to be an ATA pilot. But the one thing I will say was that Mary was so professional. And after I'd heard all the WAF stories, which were quite riotous sometimes, I said to her, did you drink much? And she said, oh, no, very little. Did you smoke? No, I didn't smoke. Did you swear? I think I swore once in my life. And I thought, oh, crikey, I'm not sure you can be my heroine. I needed somebody with sort of another side to them. Anyway, she was absolutely wonderful. And I was so sad when she died. But I was so pleased that she'd been so able until those last 6 weeks. And if I can have done anything to preserve her legacy and the other women who did that job, then I'm absolutely thrilled.
And there's a wonderful coda to this story, that the reason you got in touch with the RNIB is because a former squadron leader from the RAF, a man who served as a bomber pilot in the Second World War, picked up Bobby's War from the RNIB Talking Books Library and got in touch with you to tell you how much he'd enjoyed it.
Yeah, be careful now, because you're making me quite emotional. It's stories like that that make this journey that I'm on, this very unexpected journey, because I started writing in my 60s. I'm now 69, heading towards 70 at a rate of knots. And I never thought I would write one novel, let alone, I mean, I'm up to my fourth. But the thing that keeps me going are people writing in saying how much the books have meant to them. And it's not just, yes, I liked your book, it was a nice story. They really seem to resonate with people. And I think that is probably down to the huge amount of blooming research that I do. I have to check every single thing out. And to have a message like that from that gentleman, it just made my day. I can't tell you, to know that he had enjoyed it so much. And the other thing was that actually he was there and he didn't point out any howlers. He didn't say, you didn't tell it right. Everybody who's been in the services who've read it say that my books take them back to it. And that means I'm getting something right. And I can't tell you what that means to me.
Something else that I think you and your publishers have got right is the selection of narrators for the Talking Book versions. Rosie Jones does a fabulous job of reading Bobby's War and really does transport you back to the 1940s.
I have to say, Bonnie Azaf have been absolutely wonderful with me. They know exactly what they're doing. They pick these girls with great care to read the stories to make sure that they represent the character. And when I hear them, I go, that's her. Which is really odd for me, because I've heard this voice in my head for so long. So it is wonderful. And I think when you hear them on audio, they come to life in a way that they wouldn't have done visually. I worked in BBC radio and television, and I remember a story about a child saying that they liked radio because the pictures were better. And I love that image. And I always loved radio because of what it could create in your head.
The cow's huge black eyes stared impassively from its position at the front propeller of the Tiger Moth aircraft. Roberta, Bobby for short, stuck her tongue out at it, but it carried on chewing. The aircraft was being rocked by the skittish movements of the 20 or so Frisian cows that had raced across the field to examine this enormous bird that had seemingly fallen out of the sky. "Ha! Fallen my foot!" Bobby told her sceptical audience. It was skillfully landed, despite crosswinds and the fact that this moth's nose is high on landing. She pushed her thighs together and winced. She needed to reach the hedge and quickly, but she scanned the herd and they showed no sign of moving.
"Shoo!"
she yelled at the crowd around her. But still they did not react. A farmer's daughter, she had no fear of cows, but she gave them enormous respect. She breathed in sharply and tensed her stomach. She should never have had that last cup of tea.
Rosie Jones, narrating Bobby's War, written by my guest, Shirley Mann.
And Shirley, as you mentioned earlier, I know it's incredibly important to you that books are made accessible to those with sight loss because of your own mother's experience.
Yes, my mum lost a lot of her sight, not completely, but a lot. And she was always an avid newspaper reader and she enjoyed listening to radio and things like that. And she lost a lot of her hearing and her sight, and that made her very isolated. But it's so important to me that people have accessibility to these things. And I think the RNIB just do an amazing job in getting these worlds out to people so that they don't feel as isolated as my mum did.
I believe we've got a third book on the way soon, Hannah's War. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, Hannah's War is a little bit different because she is a Land Army girl, and I'd done these two very feisty, very strong women. And I thought there's another story to tell here about the girls who actually were forced to take on these roles, who were shyer, perhaps, than maybe my mum and Mary Ellis had been. So I went to talk to various Land Army women, and they were absolutely wonderful, but so self-deprecating as to what they did, because somehow the Land Army girls were made to feel as if they weren't doing as much as those who were doing the glamorous jobs. And I thought, hold on a minute, I'm going to make sure that everybody knows just what these girls went through. And Hannah's a Land Army girl who is terrified of everything and all of a sudden has to deal with a huge shire horse, a tractor, days and days of backbreaking work picking sprout stalks in freezing cold weather. And the more I wrote about this girl and the more I found out, the more I just was blown away by these Land Army girls. I think they're absolutely amazing what they did, because the reality was Germany got feeding their nation wrong. And therefore, they didn't have the backup of a very strong nation behind them because everybody was basically starving. Whereas in this country, because they really did get the agriculture correct, it meant that it gave a base of solidarity and positivity there that Britain could survive and Britain could move forward. And I found that amazing. And again, an unsung story. So I struggled with writing Hannah, I will say at the beginning, because I thought, oh God, I just want to shake this girl. But then as I got into her, I just stood back and thought, no, actually, madam, you are fabulous. And I loved the transition of her becoming the strong woman that she always was, but didn't know how to show.
And another aspect that readers might not have realised is that girls like Hannah were having to work next to German and Italian prisoners of war, which was pretty frightening.
Yes, that was an angle I really wanted to get across. My dad had always taught me that it wasn't the German people's fault. It was a regime that took over. And therefore, he had no acrimony against German people. And I wanted to put the other side of the story. And I thought it would be fascinating to have a German prisoner of war as a central character. And I really enjoyed finding out what his life and his background was like and what his family were going through, because I hadn't realised, and that's an area that I had to explore that I don't think is explored very much. These young men were forced to go into the services, but they were also very seriously brainwashed as members of the Hitler Youth. And I've got a German friend here who said, don't pretend they weren't. There was a huge brainwashing exercise that went on from the moment that they joined Hitler Youth. So I did want to get that across, and the life as a POW, which compared with what our soldiers were putting up with in Germany, was a lot better. The British government were terribly careful to make sure that they couldn't be accused of mistreating them, because they knew it would come back to haunt the prisoners on the other side of the channel. So in actual fact, they had a lot of privileges that local people didn't have. They had meat because they were German. They were given cheese for breakfast. All these little snippets of information that, again, I don't think are particularly in the history books, that I found out. And I really did enjoy looking at Karl's journey as well. I thought that was fascinating.
Shirley Mann, thank you so much for taking us into these hidden histories that might otherwise be forgotten, and for being a guest on the show.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, Red. Thank you so much for asking me. I've loved it.
Both Lily's War and Bobby's War are available as talking books from the RNIB Library, where they'll soon be joined by Hannah's War. And Shirley Mann will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Libby Clegg reveals how her guide dog has helped break down barriers with members of the public and got her through some of the lows of being a Paralympian. But first...
Penny Melville Brown is a retired naval commander and disability activist and the founder of Baking Blind. She's also an avid reader and has kindly agreed to do a series of book reviews for Read On. Penny, welcome back, and what have you been reading recently?
Well, thank you, Red, and it's been a hot summer in places, and so I've been reading quite a lot, and I thought today I'd pick up three American authors. And as I was reading them, I was thinking, why am I not reading great literary novels of the English heritage? Why am I reading these books? And I realise that actually they're much more like Tom and Jerry cartoons, with everything is fast and furious and excessive and not too challenging, just simple for hot days when you want to relax.
Sounds perfect.
So I thought I would start with Lee Child, and you've probably heard about the Jack Reacher series. I think there are over 20 books in this series, and in fact, Lee Child has now passed the series over to his brother, who is going to write more. He's probably just got fed up of Jack Reacher, who is this retired American Army military policeman who runs around America beating up anybody who comes in his way. He's an absolute champion for right and discards the wrong, and it is absolutely Tom and Jerry, and I just love them, and they have enormous pace. So I've been reading 61 Days and No Going Back, and I'm just in the middle of A Wanted Man. But I particularly wanted to pick up The Affair, which is a really interesting book, and this must be around about book 15 in the series, I think, which actually gives you some insight into why Reacher left the army that he so much loved. So my recommendation would be to start at the beginning, knowing that you're going to get to an explanation after about 15 books. But if you're just desperate, just go in there at The Affair.
I finished saying my piece, and he started talking, and the first thing I found out was that he wasn't a small-town cop. Garber had been wrong, technically. Carter Crossing had no police department. Carter Crossing was in Carter County, and Carter County had a county sheriff's department, which had jurisdiction over everything inside an area close to 500 square miles. But there wasn't much inside those 500 square miles except Fort Kellam and the town, which was where the sheriff's department was based, which made Garber write again, in a sense.
Jeff Harding narrating The Affair by Lee Child, which is available from the RNIB library.
Oh, he talks with a deep, dark voice.
Doesn't he just?
Okay, well, my second bit of light, great, fun reading. Again, it feels like a cartoon because it's Robert Crace, The Wanted. And again, this is a long series of books starring Elvis Cole, who is the private detective. You know, he's charming, witty, affectionate, doesn't have to prove his manhood, but he's full of charm. And his sidekick, who is called Pike, who is muscular and tough, and all the things that you want some macho man to be, but underneath, you know, he's got a heart of gold. I love these books. There is lots of humour, right from his Pinocchio clock in the office, all the way through to his approach to his clients and who he's trying to sort out. So I would really recommend Crace to anybody who wants a fun book for the summer. This is a simple story of a couple of juvenile criminals who get in way above their head with killers on their trail. And so Elvis Cole comes in like the White Knight with his pal Pike to protect him to sort out the situation, catch the baddies and make the goodies feel much safer in the long run. Good stuff, you know, nice and simple.
Stems hated the place. The crowd was a sweaty press of hipsters, drunks, pretenders, and wealthy foreign nationals, all pounded by the sonic hammer of a Swedish DJ spinning a hip-hop dance mix. Stems and Harvey split up to find the busboy, hiding their search in jokes and banter. The employees they questioned did not realize they were being questioned. None of them knew they were being asked about the busboy. Stems and Harvey were good.
Luke Daniels narrating The Wanted by Robert Crace, which is available commercially.
Okay, well, this is another American author, but this is a woman. And actually, people who've heard me before know I don't read a lot of women authors because they're always worrying about tossing their hair and, you know, whether they're cracking their fingernails, which it drives me crackers. But Sue Grafton, I have really enjoyed her. Again, another long series of novels. And this is about an American private investigator, female, Kinsey Millhone. And she has operated from the first book in the series, which was A is for Alibi. And now she's up to X. So she's only got Y and possibly Z to go. So Kinsey is inadvertently involved in a huge double cross and a neighborhood scam. So you've got sort of rather slick crime, but something that's a bit closer to home as well. And she's tough and resilient and has a sense of humor, is self-deprecating, far less of a cartoon character, but still just a bit two-dimensional. But a nice read. I've really enjoyed this series. So again, this is somebody that lots of people will know already, and I can just commend to them, keep on reading the series. It's worthwhile.
Teddy Zanakis would have to steal the painting. What other choice did she have? She believed it was a Turner, a possibility she couldn't confirm unless she shipped it to the Tate in London, where the Turner scholars, Evelyn Jall and Martin Butler in particular, could make a judgment about its authenticity. Unfortunately, the painting was currently in the basement of the house that was now solely in Ari's name, where it had sat for years, unrecognized and unappreciated. She might have blamed herself for the oversight, but why on earth would anyone expect to find a priceless painting in such homely company?
Liza Ross, narrating X by Sue Grafton, which is available from the RNIB library. Thank you, Penny. And in between all your reading, I believe you've also been very busy with Baking Blind.
I am. I am still doing the online demonstrations for particularly visually impaired people, blind people like me. We're going to get ahead of ourselves and make Christmas mincemeat because, of course, the apple harvest is coming in and so we need to use cooking apples in the mincemeat. So that'll be fun and people can find that online through the Open Site website. But I've also been writing, I thought, a Christmas present for other visually impaired people. So So I'm pulling together a little booklet of some of my best recipes with videos, and I'm hoping that I can put it out to various organisations all over the world so that blind people can just download it. It'll just be simple and they can make it accessible because it'll be as just a simple Word document. So you can turn it into Braille or large print or just use it on a screen reader. So I hope that would help people. And then they can link to the videos too.
That sounds brilliant. And I hope you'll come back onto the Daily Connect to tell us more about that when it's finished. In the meantime, if people want to keep up to date with what you're doing, where can they find out?
Well, I publish a blog weekly and I also am on Facebook. So I think they just need to go and look up Penny Melville Brown.
And
don't forget the hyphen.
And three L's in Melville.
Yes.
Penny Melville Brown, thank you once again for your fantastic book recommendations, and I'll look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks, Red.
Hi, this is Sunday. I'm a partially sighted person, and I have a little bit of experience in the world of distance running. So I want to talk to you today about a book called Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. So this is a 2009 bestseller by American author and journalist Christopher McDougall. So in this book, he talks about his deep dive into the world of ultra running. So to the unfamiliar reader, ultra running refers to running distances which are typically longer than a marathon. So a marathon is 26.2 miles. Ultra running often involves running races which are 50 miles or 100 miles or even longer. This is typically done across challenging terrain or in difficult climates. And yes, such a thing exists and has been growing in popularity over the last few decades. There are many interesting aspects to this book. Perhaps the most interesting part of this book is his discussion on the Tarahumara tribe, who are found in the Copper Canyons of Mexico. So this is a tribe that has been pretty much as they are for thousands of years. And what is unique about them is that they travel extremely long distances on foot. So they would have elder people, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, 70-year-olds, who would traverse 50 miles, 60 miles, even more in a single day. And so Christopher McDougall talks about this tribe and their way of life and talks about how healthy they are, and they don't seem to suffer from many of the diseases that are often seen across the Western world. There are other aspects of this book as well which are a little bit more contentious. So for example, he talks about how distance running has been integral to the survival of humans in history, and that our ability to move a great distance is unique. So he often refers to a squirrel being able to run much faster than a human over a short distance. However, there aren't many land mammals that can travel as fast as humans over big, big distances. I mean, there are a few exceptions, but humans are up there in terms of some of the best animals on the planet when it comes to big distances. And so it's a fascinating book about distance running, and he's pretty much making the case that it is natural for us to move great distances, and that it makes us feel better, it's good for our health, and it's the way humans ought to live. So you may not agree with everything that's said in the book, but it's definitely an engaging and interesting read. I hope you enjoy. Thank you.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Shirley Mann to share the books of her life, here's Read On reporter Ellie Marsh.
Libby Clegg may be best known as a gold medal winning Paralympian, but through lockdown, she's taken to writing, looking back on the last 6 years with her guide dog Hattie, to give us a glimpse into her life and the relationship between a person and their guide dog. I caught up with her to discuss the book, My Life with Hattie, 6 Years with a Dog Who Does Everything, which is available on Audible now. Libby Clegg, welcome to Read On.
Hello.
So, gold medal winning Paralympic sprinter, Dancing on Ice finalist, MBE, and now author. Congratulations on writing your first book. How does it feel?
Do you know what? I've had so much pleasure writing this book, just because it's made me reflect on the past, well, now 7 years of my life, and what a great time I've had with Hattie and what a huge impact she's had on my life.
What did you enjoy the process of actually going back and thinking about those different stories and getting them into text?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just going back and like thinking about when I first got her and leading up to getting her, and just like some of the little funny things that you forget about that have like happened, some of the trips that we've been on. So I really enjoyed that process of like remembering and reflecting on those times. It was really nice.
And I suppose through going back through the time that you've had Hattie, you're sort of going through all those different life events and things that have happened through your life, as well as the relationship with Hattie, is sort of the life events that have happened through that time as well.
Definitely. So when I first got Hattie, it was now 7 years ago, and just for me coming to terms with making that decision to even apply for a guide dog and really not knowing how I felt about it, to be honest, because I really kind of felt like having a guide dog would make me, it sounds really silly, but make me really disabled. And I feel like I'm a very independent, confident woman. So I was like, oh, I just feel like that would be a bit of a hindrance on life. And I only did it really because my parents were like, you know, you really need to look after yourself, because I was ending up in all sorts of situations, like walking into hedges and nearly in the road and things. So just even thinking back, like, it feels like such a long time ago now. And then just getting her and realizing what a huge impact she had on my life, not just the physical element of my life, where, you know, getting me from A to B, but like I say, I thought I was always a confident, independent person. And then when I had Hattie, I just felt like I didn't have to explain myself to anybody more, like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders. You know, I didn't have to go bore everybody with my whole story, like, oh, excuse me, I'm registered blind, can you help me, you know, find the flower or something, you know. Having Hattie there is just an instant like breakdown of barriers with that other person and awkwardness. And yeah, it's those things that have made such a huge difference. And obviously she's been to lots of different events with me, and getting to share those experiences with her as well has been fun at times.
So the book itself is called My Life with Hattie, 6 years with a dog who does everything. And I love that title, by the way. And it's all about your life, like you say, over the past 6-7 years with Hattie. What was it originally that, because you're a busy woman, I'm sure, what was it that made you think, actually, I want to go back and look at the last 7 years and actually get into writing and tell my story with Hattie? What made you want to do that?
A lot of people ask me about my sporting career and talk to me about, oh, you know, you should write a book about that. And I find it really boring. And I know it's probably because it's my life. I just think, oh, that's really, really it's really boring. I always think there's more to me than just my sport. And Hattie's been such a huge part of my life, you know, over the past few years, that there's so many interesting things that have happened and silly things that have happened that people are probably more likely to relate to. And it just gets people to know me a bit more, me as a person and not just me as an athlete. Do you know, everybody can see the outcome of, you know, my races and things, and you know, read about my injuries, but no one ever really gets to see that other side of my life, and Hattie's a huge part of that.
So do you think that's kind of what this book does, is open up sort of the more personal human side of Libby Clegg?
Definitely. And talks about, you know, some like the little blind quirks, the weird things that I do as like coping strategies, and some of the silly things that I've had to get over, like, you know, getting in strangers' cars and brushing my teeth with hair removal cream and all those stupid things, or like putting pepper in my coffee, you know, all those silly things that you do.
What did hair removal cream taste like?
Vile. I don't recommend it to anybody. It's because it looks like toothpaste. And my brother was swimming at the time, and he used hair removal cream to make himself nice and smooth and streamlined in the pool. And yeah, I was at home and I thought it was toothpaste.
So when you first met Hattie, you said that you were reluctant to get a guide dog in the first place. How long did it take to sort of build up that trust and that connection with her?
To be honest, I think it probably took a few weeks to really build that trust up, probably more really with her than me. I mean, guide dogs, they're used to working with lots of different people, so I didn't feel particularly special to Hattie. I felt like she would be a total traitor and leave me at the first sight of any food. But it took a little while. I genuinely was ecstatic to obviously meet her and work with her, and I instantaneously knew that it was going to have a really positive impact on my life having a relationship with her. Like any sort of friendship, it takes a little while, doesn't it, to build up. But I did fall in love with her. She's just gorgeous.
And she's like you say, almost like a friend. And in the book, you've spoken about how Hattie's helped you through some sort of tough times in your life. And you've spoken before about this, I know, about when you've come back from Rio and you were feeling quite depressed when you came back, and Hattie helped you through that. You discussed that in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that time and how your relationship with Hattie helped?
I never realised this, to be honest. Like, obviously, because she was with me every day anyway, and obviously I was away in Rio for about a month and I hadn't seen her. And then when I came back, I was kind of out of my routine, so I wasn't going out as much and that kind of thing. And just having her there, she, like, needed me to, like, obviously do the basic stuff like feed her and take her for walks and that kind of thing. And I think her just being that stability in my life massively helped me, and keeping me in a sort of routine, but also then just being there for a cuddle when I needed one, because she spent many a day with me on the sofa having a snuggle, just because I just felt so low. And just having her there really, it just made me feel that little bit better.
In the early days, I used to find ending these meetings difficult, as I was afraid of appearing rude. Also, Hattie often gets approached by older people, and I always have a horrible feeling that they might be lonely. The catalyst for me becoming more ruthless in these situations was when a woman kept me chatting for over an hour one day, and I really did end up missing a train. I must have tried 20 or 30 times to make her excuses, but the lady just carried on talking. I vowed from that day on to be more assertive and armed myself with a list of excuses. The pick of which was, "You'll have to excuse us. She's had really bad diarrhoea and we're due at the vets in 5 minutes." That usually clears the way, so to speak. One of the reasons why people are so attracted to Hattie, and to dogs in general, is because they don't judge like we do. Social media has made it easier than ever for people to judge one another. So being able to spend time with somebody who is pleased to see you, with no strings attached, even for just a minute or two, is a blessing. I often hear people say that they prefer the company of dogs to people, and in some cases, I can see why. It all depends on what kind of mood you're in, I suppose, or at least it does with me. The difference being that I never tire of seeing Hattie or spending time with her, whereas with humans, I do.
Lucy Fish narrating My Life with Hattie, written by my guest, Libby Clegg. People do connect with animals sort of on a different level, especially with something like a guide dog. I mean, you're with Hattie more than you're with any other living being on the planet. I'm just wondering, if you can dish the dirt, have you ever fallen out? Because people fall out with their pets. I've fallen out with dogs in the past. Have you and Hattie ever had any spats?
The only time Hattie falls out with me is if I've been away and she's a bit cross about it. She sort of snubs me for a couple of days. And the only other time I tell her off is if I find her in the bin or chasing Edward round the house with his biscuit or, you know, a bit of toast that she's after.
Is she a bit like a dustbin?
Oh, yeah. She's literally a walking dustbin. But it's quite funny because when she's not the most cuddly dog, like, she'll decide when she wants to cuddle. But sometimes I think, oh, she's in a bit of a mood with me. But she's just going in her bed for a little bit of quiet time or a little bit of time to herself. But, you know, she'll come in for a cuddle when she's ready.
So what was the process of writing the book like when you were figuring out, looking back over the 7 years and picking out the stories that you might have wanted to include and ones that you decided that you didn't want to include? What was that like, picking out specific things? Because a book can only be a specific length. You can't have everything in it that you want to. How did you pick the stories that you wanted to include?
I tried to pick, like, some of the most funny ones, and then some of the ones that sort of explain probably a bit more about the background of obviously not being able to see very well, because it's not all just about, you know, I don't know, it's not just all about the sort of day-to-day things that sort of happen. There's, like, I call them blind quirks, because a lot of blind people have, like, little quirky things that they do that sighted people don't do. And I think I was trying to explain, like, those elements of it as well, so the reader had, like, a bit more of an understanding of those elements of your life and why you do sometimes do really strange things or may appear strange to sighted people. So I just wanted to try and make it, like, whole, and I was wanting to give, like, a full picture rather than just bits of the picture, and not just the bits of the picture I wanted people to see. So there's, like, the good and the bad and the ugly in there. There's a bit of everything, and I just wanted to give a really well-rounded image of my actual life and and how different things have affected me.
Was that something that was important to you from the outset to show that it's not always easy?
I think, like, I'm a really positive person and I don't let my disability get me down at all. But there is parts of being visually impaired that are really frustrating, and it's good to share those things because, you know, if you just share all the really good things, it's actually really boring. Like, people don't relate to you. And I wanted people to be able to relate to me because at the end of the day, I am just a normal person and I have, you know, problems and challenges just like everybody else. But I also have, like, some really positive experiences that, you know, other people can have too. So I just wanted to make sure it's a well-rounded picture of everything, and it wasn't just the bits that I wanted people to know. It was, like, the bits that, like, you know, you don't really want people to know, because they're harder to share sometimes.
Absolutely. And when you were did you write this book through lockdown?
Yeah, so I wrote it with I am not the most academic person in the world, I'm not gonna lie. So I wrote it with a ghostwriter called James Hogg. So we did a lot of work together during lockdown where we were bouncing different ideas off one another, and I got to go through all these memories and reflect on all these things. So it was quite nice during lockdown to do this because it kept me quite occupied. And it was nice to reminisce about, you know, times pre-COVID, to be honest, where we could have a bit more of a normal life.
Focusing on the good things.
Definitely. I think that was well needed.
And what was that relationship like with the ghostwriter? How did you find him in the first place? And what was your working relationship kind of like?
Do you know what? James is an absolutely brilliant person. We normally, I think, what they can do is they, like, spend a few days writing everything down, like going through everything, so like a full day. Whereas we kind of just did it in different stages of my life. So we had multiple phone calls over lockdown and just gradually built up a picture. And then it gave me time to, like, reflect and think, oh, actually, I remember something else that happened during that time. So it was really good for me to sort of go back and think about those things. And the way that we did it was, it was really good for me to be able to do it in little chunks and little stages instead of trying to think of everything all at once. So no, he was really, really lovely and really great. Dan, I think he's done a really good job of capturing what, like, my feelings were and situations that have happened and helping me put them on paper.
Have you ever considered writing a fictional book?
Do you know what? A couple of people have said to me about writing a fictional book, but like I say, I'm not the most academic person. I just don't think it'd be very, I didn't think I'm creative. Like we did other people, it's just not very good at writing my own.
So the audiobook is read by Lucy Fish. Can you tell us a little bit about why you chose Lucy and whether you had any input in Lucy getting chosen to read the audiobook and what you think she sort of brings to the book in itself?
So I got sent a couple of clips of different voices because initially I did think about reading the book myself. However, I'm a very slow reader. And I thought it'd sound like a four-year-old was reading it. So I was listening to the voices, and Lucy's voice to me, it doesn't, I don't know whether it maybe sound, I feel like she sounds a bit like me in my head, a bit better spoken than myself. But she, for me, I just thought she'd be the best person. I really like her voice, and I think it'd be, she's easy to listen to.
Was it strange to listen back to your own book?
Yeah, do you know, it's really strange listening back to your own book, because I don't know, because I think it makes it a little bit more real. Because I obviously don't, I don't really read, physically read. So hearing it is a bit strange. It feels different again. But no, she's done a great job, and I'm really happy.
We're running out of time, but I just wanted to talk about finally what you want people to take away from the book itself.
For me, I think it's just, you know, life has lots of ups and downs and lots of challenges. And for me, I know I've had a really successful career, but, you know, it's been a rocky road. There's been lots of barriers that I faced along the way. And for me, it's been about sort of my bounce back ability. And I think the book really shows that not only in my sporting life, but also my day-to-day life as well. And it's not necessarily about, you know, some of the challenges that you face. It's how quickly you can bounce back from them and recover rather than what that struggle is and how long it's going to take you.
That's a great message that everybody will take on board, I'm sure. Thank you, Libby, for joining us And your first book, My Life with Hattie, 6 Years with a Dog Who Does Everything, is out on the 8th of October. Are you excited? Are you nervous?
I'm really excited. I've received a couple of hardback copies and it looks incredible. So I'm super excited.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Libby Clegg, for joining
us. Thank you. Thanks very much.
And Libby Clegg's book, My Life with Hattie, 6 Years with a Dog Who Does Everything, is available now on Audible.
Thanks to Libby Clegg and Ellie Marsh.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helpline's open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
Now it's back to Shirley Mann for the books of her life.
Shirley, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I have always read. I mean, I used to go to the library on a Friday and pick up 4 books and I'd read them all by Tuesday. But as a child, I read a lot. And I have to say, I was a child of Enid Blyton era. Well, just after. But the book that I remember, even to this day, was The Faraway Tree by Enid Blyton. There's a trilogy in there. But The Enchanted Wood, with the characters of Mr. Moonface, Silky, the fairy, the saucepan man who could never hear anything because he was surrounded by pots and pans, Dame Washalot. All these characters, they just came to life for me. And this tree where the children would go up, there were 3 children, I think, Joe, Bessie and Fanny, and they discovered this tree. And they would go up and each time there was a different land at the top. And there was always that jeopardy of the children not getting down in time before the tree moved on to the next land. And those magical worlds, I love being taken somewhere by a book. And I remember reading it as a child and not being able to put it down. And my husband and I, when we can't hear each other or something, we say, oh, we're doing Mr. Pots and Pans, are we? It's still there in our psyche, I think.
There were once 3 children, called Joe, Beth and Franny. All their lives, they had lived in a town. But now their father had a job in the country. So they were all to move as soon as they possibly could. What fun to be in the country, said Joe. I shall learn all about animals and birds. And I shall pick as many flowers as I want to, said Beth. And I shall have a garden of my own, said Franny. When the day came for the move, all the children were excited.
Mark Straker narrating The Enchanted Wood, which, like all the books in Ina Blyton's Magic Faraway Tree series, is available from the RNIB library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, I remember the last holiday I went on with my parents on my own. I mean, my husband and I went with them afterwards. But I went through Europe in a caravan with them. And I must have been the most boring companion because I started Lord of the Rings at the beginning of the 2 weeks and I don't think I spoke. And it's that getting absorbed in a book that is so rare these days. You know, I read a lot of books and you sort of get to the end and you think, and what? Sorry, what? What happens next? Or you're reading it out of duty or you're appreciating the prose, but you're not absorbed. I absolutely love getting completely absorbed in a book. And I have to say The Lord of the Rings did it for me. And if ever I have a time when I've got 2 weeks spare, I will start it again and just read it. The depth of the language, the place that Tolkien creates, the world that he creates, it's just so magical and so different, but beautifully written. And I do like a gripping story.
Hobbits are an unobtrusive but very ancient people, more numerous formerly than they are today, for they love peace and quiet and good-tilled earth. A well-ordered and well-farmed countryside was their favourite haunt. They do not, and did not, understand or like machines more complicated than forge bellows, a water mill or a hand loom, though they were skilful with tools. Even in ancient days they were, as a rule, shy of the big folk, as they call us, and now they avoid us with dismay, and are becoming hard to find. They are quick of hearing and sharp-eyed, and though they are inclined to be fat and do not hurry unnecessarily, they are nonetheless nimble and deft in their movements.
David Banks narrating The Fellowship of the Ring by J.R.R. Tolkien, which, like all the books in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, is available from the RNIB library.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I think the one that I aspire to is Kristin Hanna. She writes a really gripping story, but she also writes well. And I've always wanted to write an accessible book and a good story, but I want it to be good writing. And I would love to think that I can do that. But her story that is related to what I've done and maybe did inspire me is called The Nightingale. And it's about two sisters in France. Now, I have a sister, and I immediately related to that. Now, one joins the resistance and the other doesn't during World War II. And their story is they get involved in two Jewish children's lives and the escape of Allied pilots, plus the relationship between these two girls. I just found absolutely gripping and loved it. And it's, again, a not an easy read, but it was one that I thought, well, if I can ever write to that standard, I'll be really pleased.
If I have learned anything in this long life of mine, it is this. In love, we find out who we want to be. In war, we find out who we are. Today's young people want to know everything about everyone. They think talking about a problem will solve it. I come from a quieter generation. We understand the value of forgetting, the lure of reinvention. Lately, though, I find myself thinking about the war and my past, about the people I lost.
Regina Regan, narrating The Nightingale by Kristin Hanna, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Shirley Mann, thank you so much for sharing your joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Absolute pleasure, I've really loved it. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope people enjoy my books.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.